It's a live room. I am so honored and delighted to be with you all tonight. I used to live in Lexington, Kentucky, and that's when I learned how to say Louisville. Before that, I lived 20 years in Chicago, and I'm now in Denver, Colorado. NACSW has been for me, as I'm sure it's been for many of you, a place of fellowship and respite. NACSW has grown enormously in the years since I first learned about it in the late 1980s. As an MSW student at the University of Chicago, not a single professor, or for that matter, student, dared speak the C word. It was lonely being a Christian in social work. Then I happened upon a 1980 article in the Social Service Review titled "Social Service, Godly and Godless." My life quite literally turned around. Martin Marty's article sparked a world of possibilities for MSW students of the 1980s, and perhaps it's still having some effects today. This short piece of history did for Christians in social work what the entire field of women's history had done for undergraduate women a decade earlier. It made us visible. It unlocked a professional history that had been only whispered about along the margins. It lifted up sources and interpretive frameworks that, while always available to us, had for a variety of professional anxiety reasons been denied or dismissed. Social work's foundation in Christian social service is still something of an embarrassment to many social work faculty even today. However, with the prestige and virtual legendary reputation of Professor Martin Marty supporting us, many of us found ways to persuade dissertation committees of the viability and legitimacy of critically evaluating intersections of social policy, social service, theological arguments, and what we now call faith-based organizations. But I was one of the lucky ones. I had it a little easier than other graduate students because the legend himself was on my committee. Professor Marty served as the co-director of my dissertation on Reinhold Niebuhr, Sin, Love, and Justice in Social Work. It took several years of working up the guts, actually, to ask him to serve on my committee. And now let me give you a few reasons why, many of which I know most of you are probably aware. The first three: Newsweek, Nightline, New York Times. As soon as I learned his name, every time I turned around, there was my teacher. Time magazine called him the most influential interpreter of religion in the country today. Former Illinois Senator Paul Simon called him, and I want to get this right, the Thomas Jefferson of the world of theology. And in 1978, the editors of 26 religious magazines voted Marty and Billy Graham as the two people having the most influence on religion in the United States. In 1978, I just told you about the Billy Graham. Now, on to his prolific publishing career. Marty is the author of over 50 books, an editor of an additional 20, more than 5,000 articles. Is it more than 6,000 now? This is an old curricula vitae that I got 2 months ago, so I'm just never sure I'm keeping up. Marty has written the 3-volume Modern American Religion series. Other books include The One and the Many, America's Search for the Common Good, Education, Religion, and the Common Good, and Politics, Religion, and the Common Good. It's estimated by one reporter that Martin Marty publishes 400,000 words per year. And this is now that he's retired. Many have noticed his comments and been influenced by them. From the days that he marched in Selma with a Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., which was captured in a New York, or in a Life magazine photo spread, to his challenges as one of the few Protestant participants in the Roman Catholic Church's monumental Vatican II summit, to President Clinton, who awarded Marty one of the first 10 recipients of the National Humanities Medal. And I would venture to guess that even our current president's administration took notice of the Newsweek cover story that Martin Marty penned, wherein he discussed the benefits of humility and the dangers of hubris or pridefulness in public life. Martin Marty has been awarded numerous honors. He has over 70, that's 70, he has more than 70 honorary doctorates. So I never quite knew if I was supposed to say Dr. Marty, or if it was just okay to just raise my hand in class. Scott Appleby, one of Marty's other students, and with whom Marty co-edited the landmark 6-volume study of religious fundamentalisms around the world. And remember now, this was years before Islamic fundamentalisms became a part of every American's vocabulary. Scott said, "Marty is not God, but he is the condition for the possibility of one." The workings of grace in Martin Marty are powerfully transparent. Marty gives and gives and gives to his students, far outspending them in generosity. He is always thinking of others, and everything is done graciously with a twinkle and a smile. The gracefulness of his service is known to all of his students, and I venture to say many, many others as well. Martin Marty is quoted as saying, "Well, if I'm going to be remembered," the reporter had asked the question, "he'd like to be remembered as a good teacher. That's always been my greatest joy and where I've always gotten the most pleasure." As one of his students, I am honored to count myself among the more than 100 dissertation writers of Martin Marty's students. For 35 years, now this is the most important, single most important thing I can tell you about him. Marty Party. Marty Party was the name that we affectionately gave the Christmas events every year that Martin Marty held for 35 consecutive years. At the Marty Party, we learned the little known fact that Marty actually was the inventor of that game called Pictionary. You know, it comes in a blue box and you draw pictures for words, right? Well, before there was a box and little pencils that came in the box that don't work, Martin Marty had developed this same exact game. And students would come to his home, play the game, and at the end of the evening, winners and losers alike would be gifted with brand new books. At the end of every Marty party, I can't decide on which set of glasses to use here. At the end of Marty party, after being ushered into the lower sanctums of Marty's 100-year-old house, we feasted on books. Every one of us left the house laden with 2, 3, and sometimes 4 or more brand new books. As a Christmas gift, you can imagine it was impossible to beat. As a result of the Marty Party tradition, I have served lunch or dinner to every student I have had in classes since I began teaching in 1995. It is always my greatest pleasure to serve my students and lift them up as my teacher did for me. Martin Marty introduced me to Reinhold Niebuhr. I now realize that Martin Marty is the Reinhold Niebuhr of the second half of the 20th century, and we are delighted to on a day in the 21st century to welcome him tonight.
It's worth coming just for that introduction, wasn't it? When I get to a campus where a former student is teaching, I always say, we at Chicago, we make house calls. And it's fun to renew the acquaintances along the way. I also noticed that one of the credentials, initiation rites of this convention, already it's a tradition and it's only a 45-minute old convention, is you have to show your credentials that you can pronounce the name of the city in which we are. My late first wife was from here, and when she had to teach up north in high school, she talked English. And then she'd come home for a weekend to her relatives and come back and talk about being in Louisville. So I hope I'm meeting those terms. Delighted to be invited, and I will try to give you my best. The overall theme of connecting in a shattered world, I suppose, assumes in this setting that social workers, and particularly Christian social workers, are intended to be connectors, and that the world around us since 9/11 in new ways, but the world around us immediately to every social worker is shattered, broken, in need of repair. To make those connections, of course, if you are, with a C in front of your name, a Christian social worker, the model, the exemplar, is Jesus of Nazareth, Jesus Christ. In medieval lectionaries, the word exemplar, example, had the Latin word exemplum and defined it as a clearing in the woods. You can hear the word excise, cutting out. And an exemplum was a cutting out of the trees. And what does a clearing in the woods do? Three things. One, it defines. The woods stop, you're in the dark, in the woods, tangled paths, no paths, and then you come to a clearing and it's defined. Wood stops, clearing starts. Secondly, it's where the light falls. In the wood, there's a canopy of the oak above you, and all around you there's thickness and you can get lost, and it's dark, and then you come to a clearing, night or day, it's brighter. And third, it's the place where cultivation goes on. I can remember seeing many movies of the pioneer days, and when it said clearing, it would look a lot like Hodgenville, Kentucky in American mythology. There'd be a little cabin, a little smoke coming out of it, a little cow tethered by, a little corn growing, someone hanging up some clothes, etc. The human being who is an exemplar does these three things, and the vocation of the Christian social worker, modeled after, inspired by the work of Jesus Christ, is on the one hand to be a definer of human need and response to it, is to be someone who brings light in the midst of the darkness of the many lives we serve, beginning with our own, and is a cultivator, takes the shattered world and tries to do something with it. The profession of social work doesn't always get on page one. But last Friday at 2:50 in the afternoon at the Cook County Building in Chicago, there was a fire that took 6 lives. If you know anything about Chicago, you know that 2:50 on Friday is TGIF day, and to find anybody still at work is itself remarkable. But in the Cook County Building, in the Cook County Administration, 6 people among those who escaped didn't escape. And 3 of them were social workers. And the headlines, I think, really lifted out a good deal of what we mean by the vocation. Victims shared trait, helping others. 6 who died devoted jobs, lives to service. Sarah Chapman, master social work, Loyola. Stricken with arthritis, couldn't even bend but except to embrace children, we hear. Quote, she cared so much more about other people than herself. Her funeral yesterday was at Winnetka Bible Church. Felix Deschal was a trained social worker at the University of Wisconsin, and her job at the Central State Institute of Addiction and Dependency was to train other social workers in that particular field. Her funeral was at St. Edward's Episcopal Church. And Maureen McDonald, Webster, Missouri, Master of Social Work, worked with 585 disabled adults and followed through at the end of life, always arranging for and being at the funerals of the people she'd ever worked with. Her burial was at St. Cayetan's Roman Catholic Church. Of one of them, it was said, behind her calling was to help people of any age at any time. And a few pages later, there was an article called The Call, You Must Come, which is the story of someone named Breezer Rickey, a social worker who spent her own life as a homeless person. Shielded this fact from other people in school, and somehow or other got her way to college and social work and was doing well in it, and then felt the call of Mother Teresa. I picked worms out of people's stomachs and lice out of their hair, she says, and I massaged people near death. Most of these people never had anyone touch them or hold them. It was so completely foreign to them, so simple, yet so meaningful. So right there on page one, page three, in the days when I was writing my talk for tonight, I found these relevancies and the way in which a thoughtless, heartless, shattered world stops when it's brought up short by seeing people who live more for others than for themselves. Shattered world. We're supposed to reflect on what it's meant that 2 years ago our world was shattered in new ways. A television company in Chicago asked me to do a little TV program, little half-hour packet, with children. It's called I Am With You Always, because the parents and the teachers were saying, how do they cope with the new insecurities? And so they lined up 11 little children. I love children, but it's a little terrifying to think that you know, spent 8 hours with them to get a 30-minute film out of it, but had a wonderful time. Two of them listed 9/11 as an inspirer of their own insecurities and fears. Two of them. 13-year-old in Maywood said, you want to know what insecurity is? Walk to school with me in the morning or run home with me in the afternoon. Between two gangs who will take my lunch money and try to sign me up. You want to know what insecurity is? That's it. A little on the lighter side, in the front row was a little 5-year-old boy from Ecuador. And he paid such good attention. We took a lot of pizza breaks and other breaks to keep them going all day. But there he was 8 hours later, and he was ready to answer every question and so on. And when it was finally over and the camera lights went out, he said to me, when do we get God's presence? All day long he sat there because he heard people talking about God's presence, and he assumed that he was in on the goodies along the way here. But I know his story. I know his refugee status, his exile status, his poverty status, not politically, but just out of poverty. Yet 9/11, which only two of them all mentioned, is parabolic and metaphoric and figurative for all the kinds of shatterings we know. In the midst of the Nazi period, Dietrich Bonhoeffer, a martyr to the Christian cause, said that somewhere along the way, the very groundwork of the earth shifted under us. The very groundwork of the earth shifted under us. 9/11, it hit us. World War I, we called it the American Expeditionary Force. World War II, we call them veterans of foreign wars. Expedition, foreign, protected by two great oceans, by wealth, power, military power, unmatched in history. It can't happen here. And it did. And never again in human history, I've never met anyone yet who can envision a way in which that kind of insecurity will be removed. What form it takes, we do not know. But in a world of inexpensive weapons, a world of many kinds of hatreds, there will always be threat of insecurity, which reaches into all of our lives. But if you think about what happened that day, it simply means that we joined the rest of the human race. The vast majority of the people in the world have lived in conditions like this all along. I'm directing a project on the child these days at Emory University, and so I get to read fun things, and I'm reading children's fairy tales and books about them, mainly as a corrective to Bruno Bettelheim's terribly misinterpreted version of them. And a scholar named Eugen Weber says, have you ever noticed how many fairy tales end with a lot of food? A lot of food. Hansel and Gretel eat the whole house. These grew up in a French culture among peasant children who knew they would go through life with never a full stomach. And that was Europe. That was the rich world. Think of Africa. Think of the subcontinent of Asia. Think of the Bangladeshis. The insecurity of knowing that you will never have a full stomach, never have a secure roof over your head, never know your parents. Nations like Botswana, where one-third of the men have already died of AIDS. In the Middle Ages, security. You're down the hill. We visit these beautiful castles atop the hills of Paris and France and Germany and Czecho worlds. So beautiful, aren't they? And yet, on wedding night, the lord of the manor could get himself drunk and come down and rape the bride of the wedding, first rites, first nights. And there was nothing you could do. And if he felt like it, he could burn your crops or extort. That's insecurity. And the Black Plague took the lives of one-third to one-half of all the people of Europe. That's insecurity. So we rejoined that, but we don't let ourselves be paralyzed by it. We minister in it. We do our social work in it. José Ortega y Gasset has said that real history is not made so much by war and by famine, by earthquake, and by a catastrophe, as it is when the sensitive crown of the human heart tilts its horizon even so subtly as from optimism to pessimism, from despair to hope, from utility to heroism, from insecurity to security. I've been watching the sensitive crown of the human heart tilting. For a lot of people, you wouldn't know anything is different, and for a lot of others, there are new tremors. In the middle of that world, we look for connectors. How do we connect? What I want to do with you in the time ahead, because I got one of these frightening advanced things of what you hope will happen because you lecture and you hope that your lives will be changed these ways. And I spelled out some things that I hope will happen. And one of them is I hope to help you reconceive what vocation means in relation to some other approaches to life. Catherine, a moment ago, said, I love to be a teacher, and she could tell you that in our classes, I mainly ask questions. We'd read something, and then I ask questions. Northrop Frye says, and think of yourself here and what's going on here now, the teacher is someone who attempts to recreate the subject in the student's mind. And his or her strategies in doing this is, first of all, to get the student to recognize what he or she already potentially knows. You know something about vocation and the power of vocation, but we want to lift it out tonight. And this includes breaking up the powers of repression in your minds that keep you from knowing what you know. Do I dare? What will people say? Am I bold enough? Am I equipped enough? Who'll pay attention to me? Will my precedent offend my colleagues? We have these repressions, and in the act of teaching, which is what's going on here these days, you are supposed to break up the powers of repression in your mind that keep you from knowing what you know. And, says Northrop Frye, that's why it is the teacher rather than the student who asks most of the questions. By the way, there's no quiz at the end of my talk tonight. And what I like to concentrate on here, five things to locate vocation. The words are work, job, career, profession, vocation. And as you go to the depth in vocation, each step demands more connecting, more commitment, more risk, more scariness. Work. Social work is the name of your profession. You're social workers. Everybody who works, works. That's not very differentiating, is it? Work is a very ordinary kind of term. You go to work, you have homework, you get to leave at the end of day. It's a kind of a secure world if you're employed because you get these assignments. Someone, teacher assigns homework. CEO assigns work for the day. There's a role there, and you are to be faithful in it, but the risks aren't nearly so high yet. It's easy to commit yourself to the time clock, punch card. God bless his work. It's a big part of our vocation, but it's not the vocation. Anybody can work. Not everybody has a vocation. Second one, got a job. You go to work because you have a job, so that's the second level. And again, let's hope that that is relatively secure. These days, most people we serve do not know that security, high unemployment, and globalization and phenomena that they have no control over suddenly removes the groundwork. Etch-a-sketch always has been made in a little town in Ohio until yesterday. Moving out, and there go the jobs of that town. Farmers seeing the small farms disappear, and their kids go to university and leave town and state. It's all there. But for people who have a job, there is, again, a kind of a pre-cut pattern. You can be atheist, you can be anything else, but you can somehow fulfill the terms of a job. Career. This is one of the five that bothers me most. Twice a year, our newspapers have an education supplement. And I like to see the advertisement. Almost everyone says, for your career. Everything is about career. Well, it's good you have a career. I have four sons and two foster kids, and I'm really glad to get them out of college and get them into a career. Phew, wow, that's great. Five sons in college at the same time for 13 weeks. You see why I taught strenuously and wrote those books. So they enter on careers, and the average American now is on four or five careers. Career is an organization of a job through time. But it's still not the risk of what we're looking for. It's changed so much. In colonial New England, you'd graduate from Yale College, and you'd become a minister, and for, in some cases, 60 years, you'd be in the town to which you were sent. That was your career, and there were no other questions asked. Rather secure. I like much better the next one, profession. Profession is a beautiful word. You are in the social work profession, and I wanted to linger a little while on that. The profession was invented about 100 years ago, a little over that. It was born religious. It quickly was baptized secular, and it took a long time to get to what Catherine a little while ago described, the ability to bring these two worlds together more, because the world sees these religious meanings more vividly than we had sometime. More people tonight are being healed and killed in the name of religion than anything else around the world. We better know something about it. And so the State Department and the War College, the military, the universities, the media are all catching on to this. It makes it easier to talk about it. But social work was new. Everyone knew what the professions of law, medicine, clergy were, but people didn't know these new ones. There was another student, I don't know, Catherine, you know Paul Pribbeneau? Paul Pribbeneau wrote a dissertation in social work. I commuted social work pretty often. I was technically in history and divinity, but I like social work. And he wrote a dissertation asking, what words from the theological vocabulary can you carry over into the secular or mixed world of social work that could most change it? And he chose three. One of them is the one I'm on tonight, vocation. Another was stewardship. Everything we have is a gift. And if you can get people to realize that, believe in God or not, they can still know that the culture they inherit, the institutions they inherit, all these things they inherit are not their invention. They're going to treat it differently than if they are like the person I've heard, the self-made man who therefore worships his creator. And the third is mission, having a sense that you are sent forth. That's what missio, mission, means. You are sent forth. And these developed for the new professions. He chose three: social work, public relations, and development, money raising and representation of institutions. Now, what did it mean to be in a profession? You can see the risk is going to rise a lot higher here now, and the Christian professional has deeper, more searching questions to ask. Here's a definition of profession by Louis Brandeis of the U.S. Supreme Court. profession and think of social work. It is an occupation for which the necessary preliminary training is intellectual in character, all those courses, all those books, involving knowledge and to some extent learning, as distinguished from mere skill. By the time you're doing field work, you are supposed to know a few things, and you can't just go by your skill. The University of Chicago Business School, to which I also had to pay attention because it wrapped around the Divinity School on three sides, and they're bigger than we are, and they're richer than we are, so I better learn them, had the most wonderful line in its announcements, its catalog, quoting philosopher Alfred North Whitehead, who said, "Education, it's really futile to give people only skills, because skills will be based upon present knowledge. And by the time you ever get to put it to work, the world will have moved on. We'll know new things, or we will have answers to questions no longer being asked. What you do in education for profession is to help people learn how to define a problem, to begin to learn where to look for tools, to begin to learn how to address them." I went to a seminary for 4 years. We learned how to run funerals, and I never had a funeral that looked anything like what they said they're like. The first one was a cremation, and that wasn't even in the book. I had to make up a little liturgy as I went along. But they had taught us how to think about death, resurrection, Christian life, mourning, grieving, solace, etc. And so we would learn to improvise. I'm sure that's in your case. So it's distinguished from mere skill. It's pursued largely for others. The people in the newspaper Sunday got their lives interrupted for us long enough to see that. And not merely for one's own self, and in which the financial return is not the accepted measure of success. Talcott Parsons says, being not engaged in pursuit of his personal profit, but in the performance of services to patients or clients or to impersonal values like the advancement of science. Now, none of us are all that selfless as that probably sounds, but that's the definition. The exemplary professional does that. He or she acquires knowledge and learning and skill and does it for the service of others and, quote, gets paid for it. Almost all of you work with volunteers, but they wouldn't list that as their profession. They have another career or profession, and they supplement this. But the full-time social worker is in it. It's an occupation based on a definable body of organized knowledge, what the textbooks try to organize. There are experts. At some level, it's a moral commitment of service to the public that goes beyond the test of the market or the desire for personal profit. And there is a relative independence or autonomy in professional life. They turn the teacher loose and she teaches. They turn the preacher loose and the preacher preaches. They turn the social worker loose and the social worker has to improvise. Relatively autonomous. Yes, you report. There are state standards and there are agency standards and all the rest. And yet, exactly what you're going to do facing the various circumstances of children, of the aged, of the disabled, of the addicted, very improvisational. That's part of what it is to be a professional. We used to say somebody's a real pro, we mean she or he has gotten a hold of enough of it that they can improvise and adapt to circumstances. Real pro is a compliment. Professionalism is an insult. That's using your profession as a shield. You're in a cocoon. There's a callus between you and the one you would serve. So in all these cases, profession is great, and I like Christian professionals. Still realizing its limit. We've not yet reached the level of vocation. Some years ago, a nurse at Notre Dame wrote a fine book called In My Professional Opinion, Wendy Charlton, in which she said, first-year med school, the students are still able to deal pretty broadly with the human scene. They come from liberal arts colleges, they're raring to go, they're eager to learn what the profession is, and they really are open to this. Second year, they have to start making the rounds. And for the sake of efficiency, it has to be, it can't be otherwise. You couldn't function if you didn't have it. But in the process, you learn the language of medicine, or social work, or theology. You learn that language, you begin to forget the others. In Charlton's world, anyone who studies things like medical care knows that if your professional opinion is only medical, you're not doing justice to the person lying there who has economic questions. Who'll pay for this? Legal questions, whom do I sue? Family questions, what does my aunt think? Religious questions, what do the community supporting me think and do? They're all there, and the profession narrows it. Again, inevitably, necessarily. It's not bad, you just have to remember that it's limited. But one of the ways breaking through, you thought I'd never get there, number five, vocation. Jose Ortega-Gasset, whom I've quoted earlier already, says that the goal should be to live a full, concrete, integral life in community and not to be obsessed with a social schema of a career. You can see why I don't like career quite as much. One of my sons went to Colorado College and was moved to do some Mennonite and Lutheran work in Cameroon for 2 years. And classmates would say to him, Peter, we really envy you. You know, you have experiences. I mean, something will happen in your life. But did you ever think of this? When you get back, you will be 2 years behind. Because they knew that by then they should have the MBA. They should be assistant expediter. They should... And he said, well, what if I fool you and live to be 84 and you only live to be 82? I'll have caught up. To live a full, concrete, integral life and community and not to be obsessed with the social schema of a career. Now, what are the features that go into vocation? Well, number one, the word is call, calling. In today's world, people are a little embarrassed by that. I often deal with theological students. I'm retired 5.5 years, but they still come by and talk about their... And I say, how did you experience your call? It's a little embarrassing. You talk about that in 2003? Yes, you do. And I find that they're liberated when they know they're in a climate where they're allowed to talk about it. Almost none of them ever got their call like Paul the Apostle on the road to Damascus. A blinding flash coming their way, sudden reorientation of all life. It usually comes to what I call billions of particulars. Little nudge here, little nudge there, little disappointment here, little setback there. All I ever intended to be was a pastor, and I got to be a pastoral teacher. Before that, I had thought I'd be an artist and wasn't very good at it. Thought I'd be a poet, was worse at that. Thought I'd be a writer, and I still am. But I thought I'd give seminary a chance, and Friday afternoons, when the other people in those days, men in seminaries, all the guys were out golfing and other stuff, 13 of us pile in a yellow bus and go out to Cox Sanitarium, where we dealt with dying patients. It's hard to believe, that's only 54 years ago, that on each bed, right ahead of your own head was a number, 4, 3, 2, or 1, told what stage of tuberculosis you're in. And we got to be number one, that's going to be the last week. And you could know that, and we could know that. And we're plunged in there, inept, inexperienced, and so on. And on the way out, we felt self-pitying, whiny, begrudging. And coming back, we sang. We were happy. Nobody ever left without having been ministered to by these people who are at the deepest edge of life along the way. And it came to many of us to say, I want a part of that. Well, I think an awful lot of the calling to social work comes from people who have seen human need and haven't seen human need always addressed in all these ways. And that means that it has your name on it. Out of these billions of particulars, you sort out the stronger signals from the weaker. And then you bet a little more. Doug Hammarskjöld said, you dare your yes, and then the rest follows. Number two, vocation means you have to be ready for delight and disappointment and a lot of shifting around. I'm going to quote another former student, Deanne Lagerquist, who teaches at St. Olaf College. These days, the Lilly Endowment is really interested in vocation, and quite a few colleges have grants to study this. And she's one of these, and she says, Quote, for years I've told students, if you hate bugs and love a hot shower, I think it's unlikely that God is calling you to a mission in the jungle. My dramatic statement with this trivial example of dislikes and pleasures is meant to emphasize two important aspects of Christian teaching, that God intends for all of us an abundant life, and that God calls each of us according to our gifts into work and relationships consistent with that general intention. Being miserable is unlikely to be a sign that one has found one's vocation. I stand by this advice and the conviction behind it, but at the same time I become aware that the example I use may imply that one's calling is found in comfort. Perhaps I've contributed to the reduction of vocation to satisfying, fulfilling work, a view I detect in some recent discussions of vocation on college campuses and beyond. When we respond to God's call and occupy our places of responsibility, as Bonhoeffer described vocation, vocation is your place of responsibility, we often find ourselves in satisfying jobs and fulfilling careers. However, we do our students a disservice if we teach them that responding to God's grace by using one's gifts for the benefit of others, that's vocational living, will always be comfortable and pleasant. Certainly, young people making choices between good options can expect to find vocational living rewarding, but they ought not to be unprepared for the possibility of disappointment, betrayal, loss, or other experiences of the world's brokenness, shatteredness. The notion of vocation, finally, she says, extends beyond discernment of a place in life and gives meaning to the lives we live in those places in which we're called. Young people are rightly concerned with deciding which way to turn. But in mid-career, I'm more drawn to the way vocation points to the meaning in my life and the worth of my work, even when its value is unclear to me. At the end of the day, faithfulness to God is the vocational standard of success in every circumstance. In the best circumstances, one hopes the ordinary ones, duty and delight will intertwine as we use our gifts in service. So, maybe I'll start telling my students something a little different as they listen for God's voice. If you discover there are bugs where you're called to serve, may those bugs be fit to eat. Locusts, sweetened with wild honey. If you find there are no hot showers, remember you've been washed in baptism and you'll be continually refreshed by the living water. I like the spunk of that, the realism and affirmation. Number three, if you are in a vocation, if you have responded to the call of other humans, of God, of society, of culture, of nature, it has your name on it. You're irreplaceable. You are really replaceable at work, job, career, to some extent in profession. But only you have your name on your acceptance of your assignments. Some years ago, a bishop of the old Lutheran Church in America, a friend named James Crumley, was to be a chair for one of the 10 days of a meeting of the Lutheran World Federation in Budapest. And he didn't show up. Well, that was kind of an embarrassment at first. Now, I have to tell you, the Lutheran World Federation, which meets every 6 years, is not a big deal like Vatican Council. There are 54 million Lutherans, all of whom disagree with each other everywhere, so it's not that kind of thing. And it's not a big deal. But it only meets every 6 years, and there are some 70 church bodies in it. So your own body, you have a different chair each of the 10 days. So when your bishop or your president gets there, you kind of picture in a church paper at least. And Bishop Crumley wasn't there. And there was a note on the lectern saying, I had to fly home because late last night I got a call from, I think her name was Gladys, that Frank had died. Frank was her brother, and she wanted me there for comfort, beside at the funeral. And it occurs to me that there are several hundred people in this room who can share a meeting. And I'm the only one in the room that has the name husband of Gladys, brother-in-law of Frank, through whom I felt my call to the ministry. And he sent a letter to that effect to all 6,000 clergy in his body and never got one critical letter back. And I think many of them used that letter to teach their members in their various vocations what it means. I call it creative schedule interruption. I'm not a bit interested in somebody who is not faithful to the calendar and appointments, but I mistrust anyone who is so a slave to it that they can't see human need in the midst of it. Jesus healed on the Sabbath. That was creative schedule interruption. Sabbath is made for the human, not the human for the Sabbath. He didn't say the Sabbath wasn't made. Normally, you observe. But human need can call you beyond that if you have a vocation. Which leads to number four. It's a French word, untranslatable. Disponibilité. In vocation, as opposed to job and work and career, in vocation, you have to be available to others. Disponibilité, you can kind of hear the word at the disposal of here. Again, we're most interested in that when the person who makes herself available to us is already busy. It's no big deal if they're available because they have nothing to do. But your third grade teacher had her hands full and she detected the day you gulped or cried or had joy to spread and interrupted things for it. You can be in a healing profession, a social profession, and be unavailable. And people spot that in a hurry. And they spot that because soul is missing. And the fifth dimension of vocation is soul. So, calling, delight and disappointment, only your name on it, being available to others, soul. Soul, I really believe that every social work agency, every church-related hospital, college, congregation, every secular version has or does not have soul. I'm going to take a definition from Leon Cass, my colleague at Chicago, who teaches in the med school and an undergrad courses on the Book of Genesis. He's the head of President Bush's Commission on the Stem Cell Research. His definition of soul, based on Aristotle, starts by saying, the soul is not a ghost in the machine. We don't have your body that has a soul inside. It's not a pilot in a ship. Neither of those concepts of the soul are biblical. Soul is, and I'll rattle them off, and then I'll unpack them. Soul is the integrated, vital power of any organic body that is open to a future, possibility, agency, and hope. I've slightly changed these words to make it fit my way. Now think of your vocation in social work. First, integrated. You have to make the parts of your life match. Not that you don't have a private life. Very important to protect that. You'd die if you had to spill it all out every day. And they'd die if you did. We have a right to have a life of our own along the way. But that we move around with an integration, that there's a coherence between our family life and our church life and our social work. Integrated. Vital, gotta be alive. Dr. Cass, on the first day in med school, takes students to the morgue. Now these, again, are 4.0 people, very privileged, hugely subsidized. They'll still leave a $100,000 debt. But they're really juicy and ready to go. And it's going to be attractive, and you're going to make a lot of money, and you're going to heal. And he takes them to the morgue and makes them each hold the hand of a corpse. That is really hard at age 22. It's hard at any age, but it's really hard then. And you each have to say something that hand could have done yesterday. It could have held a baby, could have made a recipe, could have written, could have caressed. What's missing? All the atoms and molecules are still there. Soul, the integrated vital power, so it's gone. Then, rougher yet, they have to look at the genitals. That's really hard anytime. It means the end of the life flow. It means the end of generativity. It means the end of all these things at the time of life when you're picturing beginnings. What's missing? Soul. So it's vital. Institutions are vital. People in vocation are vital. Three, power. Some people think power is a dirty word in the Christian vocabulary. It's all over the Bible. The dunamis tou theou, the power of God and salvation. All the time. You can't do anything without power. It's how you use it. If you use it for control, management, suppression, submission, then you don't have a vocation. You have a dictatorial role. But if power is used for the sake of the other, organic, the parts have to be connected. The Pauline writings in the New Testament, cut the finger off, it's no longer vital. It's organic and it's body. The human being, again, an agency, a church. And then it has to be open to the future. That corpse is no longer open to the future. as corpse. The God of life has something else with the person that it was, but no future, no possibility. Can't do anything tomorrow. Agency, it can't act. Hope, it can't hope. Now, anyone I argue who is aware that he or she has a vocation is going to somehow represent some of those things, and you catch it. If we went around the room tonight and asked you to name the five people that had most to do with your calling, like brother-in-law Frank did for Bishop Crumley, they'd all be people full of soul. A high school near Chicago last year, a wealthy suburb with more Jewish students than anything else, chose as their commencement speaker an African-American Baptist custodian. Why? I told the superintendent, well, he's our counselor. Look, we have five. We have an addiction counselor. We have a five counselor, career counselor. We have all these counselors. He's your counselor? Yeah, he's got soul. He stops his boom for a minute and, how are you doing today? That was it. So he had a vocation. And by the way, one of the six people killed the other day, Ms. Sitchuk, had a vocation in custodian work. Said she knew more people in the building than anybody else. She'd done it for 23 years. She got there early and stayed late. That's vocation. Okay. Finally, vocation now. Shattered. I think you only learn vocation when there is some degree of shattering in your own life to match some of those around you. There's a story they tell of a student who asked the rabbi about the book of Deuteronomy, where it says you should place the law, the word of God, on the hearts of people. Rabbi, why does it say on the hearts of people? Why not place the law in the hearts of people? And the rabbi says, we place them on the hearts of people so that when the heart breaks, it will fall in. I think that's what we learn in a shattered world. Complacent people on top of things you can't reach soul. They're hard to save, hard to help. Alfred North Whitehead once said that life is marked by routine and understanding. When things work, you work with them. If you had to wake up every morning and think what you did to tie a shoe, you wouldn't get anywhere. Somebody once asked a centipede how he could keep his 100 legs apart, and he started thinking about it, he couldn't move anymore. What you can put in routine is fine, and a real pro can put a lot of things in a routine so that you're free for the exception. But then when there is shattering, brokenness, 9/11, insecurity on the walk to school in Maywood, Illinois, when there is that, there has to be understanding. I think that's why you have these regular conventions, because you come together with the various agencies that are part, etc., checking with other colleagues, newcomers with old-timers and old-timers with the new ones, to pursue fresh understanding. And the context of this shattered world now is global. In 1993, 1 year after President Clinton was elected, the little off-year elections all went Republican. And he consoled himself and got on TV that night and said, don't read much into this. It's not a referendum on the administration, because Tip O'Neill, Congressman Tip O'Neill, taught us all that all politics is local. So this is only local. The next day, William Safire, the most severe critic of President Clinton, said, Mr. Clinton, I've never in my life agreed with a word you've said, and I rarely agreed with Congressman Tip O'Neill, but yesterday you said the right thing. All politics is local, but what you two didn't notice is today the local is the national. Exactly the things that are going on in the transactions of your life are the things being fought about in the courts, in the legislatures, in the crediting agencies, in the supervising agencies, and a further extension. Last Tuesday in my job this fall at Emory, I got to interview President Carter on what happens to children in peril. And as we walked in for an hour and a half conversation being televised, he said, Kathy, well, Marty, how are we going to start? I said, well, you wrote a book about your childhood. We'll start with your childhood. Peril in his childhood. Plenty of it. And in the course of the next time, I noticed in his world, he easily glided from there into peril in the little town of Plains, and then peril in Atlanta, a poor neighborhood that he knew well, and then as governor, the state, and then president, and then Africa, his favorite place to go. And in his mind, there wasn't a big difference. Privileged people at all these places can be soulless and manipulative and controlling and miss out on life, and some privileged people are otherwise. And the poor of Atlanta and the poor of Zimbabwe are not that different in their circumstance. Abuse is abuse anywhere. And these are the same issues across the board. Global doesn't make it easy. But again, everybody you serve is affected by it. Global capitalism is certainly the prevailing ideology of our time and functioning with markets. During my last year at the university sent me out to alumni for 5 lectures with Marvin Zonis, an international economist. And he would start the talk each time by saying, I have good news and bad news. The good news is the market has won. It's only won. The Soviet Union just imploded. Nothing left of communism. China's capitalist with the dictator, but they're not communist anymore. Who believes in Cuba and North Korea? I mean, it's just gone. The market has won. It's simple. It's just really wonderful. And if you know anything about University of Chicago economics, that's what they teach, and he'll get a Nobel someday probably for saying that. They do that. And then he would say, and the bad news is, we as individuals and in our culture have not the faintest idea with what philosophy of life to greet this change. One of the Psalms in the old King James translation says, children of Israel wanted freedom and goods, and God gave them freedom, gave them goods, and he sent leanness into their souls, a wasting disease. And we are supposed to minister that along the way in the midst of the shifting institutions of our time, with not all the resources we should need or want, but still there's always that possibility. I think the charter for social work is in Isaiah 58. My translation goes like this, but there's probably a Gideon Bible in your room. You could check it up after a while and get the old-fashioned way to put it. Isaiah 58, God says, I told you to pray, and boy, are you praying. Well, you pray. I got other things to do, though, than just listen all the time. Actually, the translation is better, fasting. I told you to fast, and you fast. You just fast. You try to please me. You wonder why I'm not more pleased with your fasting. Well, you fast until you get hungry, and you get hungry, you get crabby, and you beat each other up. Look it up. Isaiah 58. Meanwhile, what is the fast I would like? And he spells out the whole program. The widow at the gate, the poor children. You don't even take care of your own relatives, says Yahweh through Isaiah. And then when that revolution occurs that you do, then beautiful end of that chapter of how God in benignity smiles. Doesn't mean the end of the problems, it means an address to them. Now, whether a vocation is Christian or not, and I believe that a non-believer or a non-Christian can sense a vocation called by their parents, by their teachers, by exemplars, by valuable people. That doesn't matter a lot to the client most of the time. The Bible, too, talks about, if there's a cup of cold water, who cares who gave it? But it's very important to the giver. It's very important to recognize that in the one you serve is Christ. He says it often and clearly. So I don't want to sound as if Christians have it all made in their profession and vocation because they have a Christian vocation. Some years ago, there was a magazine called Look, and none of these secular things that died before the church did. Remember, church is always going to die. And so, just look at all the things there. Half the people in this room, parents wouldn't even remember Look magazine. But in the 50s, Look magazine had every week a different, what is it to be a Jehovah's Witness? What is it to be a Mormon? What is it to be a Presbyterian? And they'd have a notable person answer these questions. Do you allow for divorce? Do you allow for, they didn't know the word abortion then yet, but that kind of question. And do you believe in the Trinity? Do you believe in the Lord's Supper? At the very end, they asked the Lutheran, very crusty editor friend, G. Elson Ruff, yeah, you have all these answers here. Do Lutherans believe theirs is the only true faith? He said, yes, they just don't believe they're the only ones who hold it. And I think that's the same way we look at Christian vocation. You look out at a world in which there are other ways to have a vocation. But I think that in the case of the Christian, there's a special reason to pursue, to listen to one's own heart and soul, to stay close to the exemplar, Jesus Christ, who motivates us, to keep our eyes open to a world of need around us, because you have already died and your lives are hid with Christ in God. And that's what it means to be working in a vocation. Thank you very much.